Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sport administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Thanks, Colleen. In this episode, we have a new feature called Sports Talk, where I'll be co-hosting with Dr. Julian Kresser, researcher, sports historian, and sociologist. We take on some very topical issues, and today we'll be hearing about a few of them. Kresser, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dalton. Glad to be here.
Yeah, man. So listen, we're going to be starting off with World Cup cricket. So the World Cup cricket has ended, and England, they have won it. they brought it home. Let's talk about the sustainability of cricket and World Cup cricket. What's your view on that?
Okay, well, if anybody follows me on Twitter, they would have seen me repeatedly tweet that this has been the worst World Cup ever. Part of that is my own, I suppose, frustration and disappointment in terms of the organization of the cup. I wouldn't say disappointment in the performance of the West Indies team, because I had absolutely no hopes for them. So there's nothing to be disappointed about.
You're like the president. You're like the president of cricket West Indies, who said never expect us to win.
That's one of the first things that he said that I've been completely on board with him about. But in terms of, you know, we have the World Cup, obviously one of the largest international sports competitions, and reflecting on, I think right now, the sustainability of specifically ODI cricket is very important. We have seen the obvious takeoff and growth of the T20 game since the mid-2000s, and a lot of people are really questioning the kind of continued relevance of ODI cricket.
Test cricket?
I think that a lot of people, you know, have this tremendous attachment to test cricket. You know, it still represents for even a lot of the players the ultimate test of, you know,
Chris, are you technical. Sure about that?
There is a lot of popularity of test. I think a lot of people now feel as if cricket needs to go forward with two formats.
Test and T20.
And that ODI cricket is kind of stuck in the middle. Neither fish nor fowl.
Chris, we're going to talk a little bit more. You're discussing something. But if you look at the crowd support for test cricket, people are hardly going to stadium to watch a test cricket. People are hardly watching it on TV. So how can you be looking as one?
Well, first thing I should say to you is that one must be careful about judging popularity by attendance at the stands. People have no time to go and sit down and watch cricket for 5 days. People have no time to go and watch cricket for one day either. T20 is right now perfect. But a lot of people follow test cricket in new forms. I mean, obviously there is the traditional television, but then there are many online platforms. There's live texting of every game that goes on. And from what I've seen, there seems to be still some love of test cricket. And certainly what is important to look onto is that a lot of administrators seem committed to the survival of test cricket. That's important. Now, how committed are they to one day cricket? I think, you know, is the question that we should put in front of us today. Because when you look on the ODI World Cup versus the T20 World Cup, there are some very important differences that come out.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think World Cricket has recognized that T20 is what is going to grow the game.
Fair enough.
It is, you know, media friendly, it is, you know, quick, it is easy to play, you know, and you
spectator
see this,
friendly too.
Everything. So you see over, I think, 100 registered cricket associations now competing in T20 cricket. And the World Cup reflects, the T20 World Cup, I think, reflects this kind of push to grow the game. You know, there are 16 teams, you know, a number of the associate teams get to qualify and play and have their kind of, you know, 15 minutes of fame. When I look on this ODI World Cup, this decision to limit it to 10 teams tells me that there are certain imperatives that the ICC has and certain things that they want to get out of ODI cricket. And for me, it's not the growth of the game.
It's just money.
It's purely money.
It's just money.
And
to share amongst a few.
And exactly. And it is in particular India money
that's
right.
Correct.
So we've had every single time India has failed at a World Cup in recent times, they've changed the format of the World Cup.
Right.
So they've come up with this World Cup format where we have only 10 teams, Only 10 teams, right? So all of this work that has been going on in all of these associate countries, the Nepal, the Papua New Guineas, the Hong Kongs, you know, I could go on and on and on, really boils down to they had the opportunity to compete against the two worst test teams to qualify.
Right.
Right? And only Afghanistan got in. So right away it tells you that, listen, ICC is not in using...
And West Indies.
and West Indies only got in because of a bad LBW decision against Scotland, right? We were one bad umpire decision away from not being in the World Cup. But the point is that ICC, to me, doesn't seem like, look, we're interested in ODI cricket as something to drive the game forward. We are interested in... maximizing profits from the Cricket World Cup. So a 10-team World Cup, round robin, which ensured that at a very minimum, India was going to get 9 games.
Right.
Right? So even if India played poorly, they were guaranteed 9 India games. Mm-hmm. Right? And it bothers me greatly as somebody who is interested in the spread of the world game to see, you know, this showpiece competition really being... structured in such a way simply to maximize India TV revenue.
No, but Chris, but isn't it that cricket in general, from Test right to T20, is now geared towards India? It's really about the Indian market, all the decisions that are being made about profit sharing, about competition, etc.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's where a lot of the money comes from. I think it is a bit short-sighted if they concentrate only on India, and I think they've recognized that, which is why I said in T20 there seems to be this push for the growth of the game. I think that they are quite happy to see T20 grow because T20 requires less of an investment. It's a much higher rate of return, which is what I'm saying, that I think just looking on it seems as if ICC sees ODI cricket as, you know, not as possibly profitable venue as T20.
Okay.
Let us organize it in such a way that we minimize our risks, we minimize what we have to put into it, and maximize what we can get out of it, which means World Cups with as many India games as possible, full stop.
And 9 India games is good, right? That's good for the market. Right. And doesn't matter what happened after.
We even see when India lost in the semifinals, Captain Kohli saying that perhaps they need to even again revisit the format and to change it. And have a format similar to the IPL where you have one person going through to the final and then the other teams kind of having a playoff, right? Yeah. And as I say, you know, it just leaves everybody who, if you had any doubt before that...
So chances are this is what is going to happen next time.
Because, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune, and India is certainly paying the piper. So I look on this World Cup, and as somebody who has long been, you know, interested, committed to cricket, I really think that what is happening here is that going forward, the 50 over World Cup loses its kind of position as the showpiece global event. They've already, I think, decided to do away with Champions Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the T20 World Cup is going to become the showpiece kind of cricket world event. And the 50 over World Cup will continue to be held, but as I say, in such a way that it really becomes largely just an income earner rather than anything to drive the growth of the game. So, you know, I think what we have to look forward to more and more and more is T20 cricket.
Listen, I agree with you. I think by and large, they have been trying to figure out, you know, how to make more money from it. Mm-hmm. The test match, I don't know, it's surviving, but I think it's barely surviving. In the sense that while people are not going to the matches, there still are not a lot of persons who are watching Test cricket, because it's still 5 days.
Yeah, and as I said,
they're trying to the Test cricket championship.
and you know, and again, it saddens me as obviously somebody who grew up on
Test match
and Test cricket.
Yeah, myself.
Right.
6 days too.
But, you know, again, it's just this kind of, you know, I think mentioned this idea of this capitalistic model and this continued desire for growth. And even if you think about what is going on now with, you know, the 100 in England, you know, there's this desire, I think, on the part of the ICC to constantly capture new markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a product that people like. They ignore the people who like the product and try to change the product to attract new people. I'm not sure how successful they are in attracting, sustain new people. Time will tell. But they're also losing a lot of the people who like the original product.
Yeah, but I get the impression though that they, in a way, they think that the Indian market is supposed to be the targeted market no matter what else happens, which is problematic because at some point that market becomes saturated and you need other people out there to get involved.
And as I said, which is why, as I said, when you look on the T20 World Cup, there's clearly this desire to be far more inclusive. Yeah. Far more inclusive. But as I said, time will tell if T20 is really something that will have any type of sustained popularity in the way Test cricket has. So maybe 20 years from now, we won't be talking about cricket any at all.
Probably.
Well, won't be talking about the West Indies.
At the rate West Indies is going, we probably won't be. Your take on that West Indies team, we won't talk long about it. I didn't watch too many of the West Indies games, to be honest with you, because I didn't expect much from them.
I am
surprised they win the first game, but
I am a tremendous sucker for punishment because I got up every morning and watched every game of the World Cup.
No, that's sad.
Even though I swore not to. That West Indies.
So that Bangladesh game, you watch it. Between West Indies and Bangladesh.
The entire West Indies Bangladesh game. And people complain.
Are you proud to come on a podcast and tell people you watch that?
Yeah. I mean, people complain about, you know, I don't know if it's appropriate for me to say, but let us say that there are moments when West Indies didn't play intelligent cricket. And I would say that, you know, that was a sustained lack of intelligence on the part of a team that I haven't seen in a long time. So that Bangladesh game was certainly, for me, a low point of the West Indies performance, but
the entire World Cup,
that was just, you know, as I said, for me the worst performance that I saw. But very quickly, just to say, you know, my thoughts on the West Indies team again, that West Indies team was neither fish nor fowl in the sense that it was not a rebuilding team. Let us pick young people, throw them in there, get experience, and plan for the next World Cup. Nor was it a team of, let us just bring in all the stars we can and see if we can just win this, right? And, you know, the results were, as I said, what I think I expected.
Yeah, I think, again, that the West Indies cricket team, you know, have no clue. Well, certainly, I don't think we have a clue what we're doing with the program and where we want to go. So some teams would use, you know, some young players and say, hey, let's start the rebuilding process now. That wasn't the process. Or let's bring in all the stars and go for the win. I think we're trying to mix it. And then we're one of the worst teams in the entire competition.
Right, and
Afghanistan got more praise.
And I think they deserve more praise. I think they deserve more praise. They, I believe, you know, although they only won, no, I don't think they won a game, but I think performed to or above, you know, expectations and their individual talents.
Chris, I think we also performed above expectations in the West Indies team.
Well, to be fair, I never expected us to beat Pakistan. So
I thought we would have lost to Pakistan. So
I think you're right.
Thank you very much. At least I win one round so far. All right, so Cricket World Cup completed. We have another one that just finished, which is the FIFA Women's World Cup. And it was one of the best Women's World Cup in terms of, well, certainly in terms of the quality also, but not just that, viewership and just overall. I think from the Caribbean, because Jamaica team was there, a lot of us really wanted to watch it.
Yes.
And in general. And then you came out with your lovely column in the Jamaica Gleaner, discussing this issue of equal pay for men and women in the World Cup. Some people say that, Cressa, there's no way we should be paying women the same as men because the women are not getting the same amount of TV rights and commercial rights and all of those. So anything else don't make any sense. So let's not talk about equality when we can't get equality in that way. Talk to us again about your view on this one.
Okay, all right. Well, I agree with you, first of all, in just saying that this FIFA Women's World Cup was a lovely spectacle. There was some great football. It was a tremendous showpiece for the talents of women's footballers.
And some people say better than the Copa America.
Well, I said that one match in particular was better than anything I saw in the entire Copa America.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Go ahead.
That, certainly, so there was some good football on display, and it shows, you know, that the women's game is growing and is certainly worth, some teams are certainly worthy of you know, attention. But of course, the kind of thing that dominated the headlines was the battle of the American team for you know, better pay. So one of the first things that I want to say is that in this particular media age that we live in, things get very sensationalized.
Easy.
People, you know, jump on bits and pieces of stories. People jump on, you know, headlines that will you know, grab attention. So the first thing that I want to say is that the battle that the American women's team are fighting is not simply for equal pay, right? Equal pay is kind of like one part of the battle, but overall it is for, you know, better treatment, better facilities. You know, there's, for instance, complaints about the use of VAR in the Women's World Cup, that you know, it wasn't trial leading up to the World Cup. In particular, the issue with the application of the rule for goalkeepers
for
penalties.
Right.
So now there's this feeling that, you know, very frequently the women's game is kind of almost used as a guinea pig in a sense, mm-hmm. you know, to test things out on. So it's not just about equal pay, it's about that kind of like wider battle for respect, you know, and equal treatment. And the first thing that I would say is, you know, there's the obvious rebuttal to that, which is men far out-earn women in terms of revenue, right? Uh-huh. And therefore, if one looks purely at the revenue that each team makes, then there is this argument to justify the men being paid far more than the women. And my point was that if we are going to look on that argument of revenue, it's also important to understand why it is that, you know, men out-earn women, right? And one of it is that one could argue that, you know, and I think that it would be very difficult to find anybody to disagree that in terms of physical capabilities and skills, men are superior to women. They're bigger, faster, stronger, right? And therefore, you know, one could make the argument that male sport is more of a spectacle and therefore more popular than a women's sport, and there are more spectators. But the other thing is that one has to be also cognizant of the fact that, you know, sport generally has had a sexist history, mm-hmm. right? A lot of modern sport as we know it, the various codes of football, including rugby and, you know, other forms of football, cricket, you know, the modern Olympic Games, you know, a lot of the sports that we know were kind of born out of, you know, Victorian England and Western Europe, and born out of a society in which had particular ideas about what was appropriate for men and women to do. And so sport has always been affected by these kinds of sexist ideas, and therefore women's sport has historically suffered. Not only has it not received much encouragement, but at various stages, women's sport has been deliberately suppressed. So we reach a point now, 150 years later, where women's sport is certainly far less popular, but it's not simply a reflection of the abilities of women versus men. As you said mm-hmm. at the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, many of the women's games were actually quite an enjoyable spectacle. If you really gave it a chance and sat down and watched that Women's World Cup, as I did, you will realize that there are some amazing talents and some very good football being played, as well as, since, you know, we're just talking about intelligent versus dunce cricket, tremendous, you know, tactical and strategic awareness. So the football is good, right? So there is that. But, you know, at the same time, women's sport has not received, you know, the kind of development, the marketing, promotion, right? And therefore, you know, that is part of the reason why women's football is not as popular. So my argument is, if we're going to talk about revenues, it's not fair to talk about, to compare the revenues of men and women until both of them have been given this kind of equal chance, equal promotion, equal marketing. So really what FIFA needs to do, what the national associations need to do right now, is to pump money into the women's game to develop it, grassroots, school level, under 19, under, you know, all the youth levels and the national levels. Market the women's game, right? And give them as fair a chance as possible to earn the revenue that their talents merit. Now, maybe in two generations, women's football will be far more popular, but maybe not as popular as men's football, we don't know, right? So for me, the focus needs not be on equal pay. what the focus really needs to be on is this kind of like equal attention to the development and promotion of both men's and women's sport, and then let the
equal
chips
pay,
let the chips fall,
right,
you know, where they may.
I think you know, and I agree with you in the sense that I think a lot of it, I've had this discussion before, is how we treat women's sport. I mean, there are two general things. The minute we say football, we assume it's males, and to explain that it's female, we have to put women beside it, etc., etc., etc. So those things subconsciously suggest to us that the sport belongs to males, and the other part of it is,
right,
is women.
Women are othered, right?
Women
are
othered.
It's a very good way of putting it.
So that's the first problem. And so once we change that, the U.S., to be very honest with you, I've been trying to do it. So they call it the U.S. men national team and the U.S. women's national team, which helps. So you already suggest that there are two different teams, but not just that one owns the right to a particular sport. The other issue for me is, then of course the media and you know how we market, how we promote the male game versus the women game in our space in Jamaica. We don't get to see women's football on TV, etc. We suggest that netball is probably the right sport for women. So we have those kind of issues. So I agree with you that fine when you talk about equal pay, but the pay may never be equal. The treatment, though, need to be equal, and then the pay comes from it if we're going to be talking about supply and demand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm reminded of an incident with the T20 Cricket World Cup the year that West Indies won both the women's and men's C20 World Cup.
Right, right, and under 19.
And, you know, there were obvious discrepancies in the prize money between the men and the women, which, again, is understandable in terms of revenue. However, what also struck me is that they had different flight arrangements. So, like, the cricketers would fly first class, all of these things. And the women, I mean, were given, like, the most basic treatment in terms of their flights and accommodation. And there's really no need for that at all, right?
Yeah. And I think in general, though, I mean, we talk about cricket, we talk about football, we talk about a lot of the different events. I think just in general, we have to look at investing more in women's sports and try and give them just that same opportunity. You talk about FIFA and ICC, etc.
Right. And again, it's interesting because we blame, you know, a lot of the kind of capitalist model of sport for some of the, you know, supposed deficiencies in sport. But the reality is, if we think about it purely from that kind of capitalist perspective, what the U.S. women's team has shown is that if you invest sufficiently in women's sport, it can become a very, very profitable thing, right? The U.S. women's national team, as one article suggested, in terms of match revenue, has out-earned the men in the last few years. Now, they're still not up to earning the same revenue as men overall,
right,
but the point that is to be made and, you know, that you're making here is that in purely in terms of money and profit, women's football and women's sport general is something that is worthy of investment in. It will provide return.
It will. I think one other challenge, certainly for me, is in the Caribbean, we still... Let's take it out of the U.S. In the Caribbean, we still do not see women's sport as that important. I mean, this is an international thing, but I find even here it's even worse. I mean, we know our situation where at one point we disbanded our own women's football team.
Right.
Until, you know, we had the Sidela Marley and the Alacran group that came and say, hey, listen, let's help right, out right, and all right. of those kind of stuff. Right. And we're having that right across.
Yeah. And I mean, we all know, you know, you have also lectured in sport at University of the West Indies. You understand that sport is not an autonomous institution. Yeah. It is closely tied into the politics, you know, into the economics of the society. And what is happening is really just a part of a larger battle for, you know, gender equality in our society.
Right.
And it's going to take time, right? But I think that what is happening is that we're beginning as societies, maybe in the Caribbean we're behind others, but to rethink and to question these traditional kinds of gender roles, and sport is going to be caught up in that. Not only just caught up in it, I think that sport has the potential to kind of lead the way in terms of breaking down some of these stereotypes and in this kind of, you know, quest for gender equality. So I think in time we will begin to see differences. At the same time, of course, because sport is physical, There are always going to be, I think, differences between men and women's sport. So, you know, we have to take that into account as well.
Talking about pay and equal pay, we're kind of moving a little bit more into another type of pay. We have in the transfer market in the European football, uh-huh. and we have free agency, which uh-huh. is an interesting phenomenon in mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. in the US in this basketball thing. By the way, could you play basketball? Can you play?
No, I can't play basketball at all. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. God gave me a few sporting talents. I used most of them on cricket, and I didn't get very far with that.
Probably you could still make the West Indies team, you know, at this rate. I am positive.
I think I can bowl and bat better than Ashley Nurse, so for sure.
I'm trying to wonder if I can do the same. Listen, so you can't play basketball, but this free agency, the amount of money that people are getting when you reach this stage of your life, well, for most of them, uh-huh. is a big thing. Now, I want to look at that, but I also want to look at, in our context in the Caribbean also, that development of, you know, players mm-hmm. investing in themselves. What are some of the things that we are seeing out there, and to what extent we're really making use of business of sports and the amount of money that is being pumped.
Yeah, man, I tell you, there are mornings I get up and question my life choices when I see some of these contracts that have been offered. But then again, as I said to you, maybe God didn't give me athletic talent for a reason, because when I see some of the contracts that these 17-year-olds sign, I honestly feel that after I'd be one of these one contract and done players.
Because a 3-year contract or a 1-year contract,
after,
and that's it.
If I get up and I see $30 million in my account, I find it hard to contemplate a coach telling me to run faster, to go for... I don't know. I mean, I just, you know...
Well, the issues with the contracts, though, uh-huh. is that, in all seriousness, if you don't run faster, then there are also deductions and all of those kind of stuff. And you can probably lose a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, man, for sure. And I mean, obviously, the serious point that, mm-hmm. you know, we're making here is that, you know, there's a phenomenal amount of money available now to athletes. And in many sports, you mentioned basketball a while ago, you know, we've seen free agency a few weeks old, and we've seen, you know, the mega contracts signed by people like Kawhi Leonard and others. There's
Durant.
Durant. There's also, you know, the European football transfer market, right. and we've seen the prices of footballers in Europe escalate immensely in the last 20 years. So
yeah, Rashika, you know, is a Chelsea fan, and she had a goalkeeper who was the last season was the highest paid, well, transferred, most money spent on a goalkeeper.
Yeah, but to be fair, that goalkeeper was part-time manager, so.
Yes. Who decided that he's not coming out of the field?
You have to bear that in mind in terms of
that is important then.
That's important to understand that he was, you know, part-time manager.
The funny thing about that is that he's still there and the coach has left.
Maybe that explains
everything.
Precisely.
Yeah, I couldn't support that team. But,
Certainly me either. But, you know, as you said, the point is that there is, you know, a lot of money available to players. They're getting rich very quickly, and you know, there's an obvious need for certain support systems to be in place to help them to manage that money.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. What I've seen is a lot of funding is there almost in every sport, even track and field now, where the IWF is trying to work a lot of these events, whether it is the Diamond League or the World Challenge, etc., etc., so much so that they're trying to narrow down the amount of activities so that people can have more in terms of not just prize money but just bonuses, etc. Mm-hmm. And I think the challenge for me though is athletes getting proper support system, whether it is psychology, whether it's mm-hmm. you know, lawyers, financial advisors, because mm-hmm. there's so many athletes, Cressa, that we have heard over the years mm-hmm. who have gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
And bankruptcy doesn't necessarily mean you don't have money sometimes,
right.
but we have seen so many who have really fallen on hard mm-hmm. times, mm-hmm. and you know, it's a real struggle after that.
Yeah, certainly, and you know, a lot of these, you know, you are far more the expert on the business of sport than I am, but So, you know, you can elaborate, but what I wanted to make is that, you know, a lot of these professional players nowadays need to realize that they are far more than simply professional sports people. They are in and of themselves entities, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's so much that comes along with being, you know, a professional in terms of the income that is earned. It's not just, you know, wages or salaries from being a player. It's, as you suggested, things like image rights. You know, it is, you know, branding, you know, and there's so much that goes into having success as a professional star than simply performing on the field. And so there's the need for this whole range of support services, you know. You mentioned psychology, you mentioned financial advisors, but what's also important right now is the need for, in a sense, brand managers, because all of these people are their kind of own individual brands. And we've seen time and time again examples of sportsmen costing themselves sometimes millions of dollars simply because of an errant tweet.
Yeah.
All right. You know, recently, I think in the NFL draft, there was a player who was drafted to play for the San Francisco 49ers, and there was a controversy because, you know, San Francisco is a very diverse city, a city in which that values, you know, inclusiveness and diversity. And he, you know, had made a number of tweets that, you know, suggested that he was not in favor of a lot of these things. And, it threw his draft position into jeopardy, right? So, you know, there's also the need for that, because in this particular age, again, of social media, you know, that management of your brand, I think, is essential.
And the truth is that, you know, there are a lot of persons out there sometimes who want to tarnish that brand or to just put things out there. I was talking to a manager the other day who was saying, listen, when something bad happens or an athlete tweets something bad, mm-hmm. it's the hardest thing to control. Mm-hmm. Or if something is said about the athlete. But if you put out a statement trying to correct that, very mm-hmm. few people read that statement.
Yes. What is the famous quote? That a lie travels half the way around the world before the truth can put on its part?
Yeah. I remember even the other day, we heard that Elaine Thompson was dead. Several times we have heard that. And immediately they had to put out statement to say, hey, listen, I've never traveled to Canada before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody said, you're getting calls, boy, condolences mm-hmm, mm-hmm. about Elaine. And we've heard this for many athletes, but nothing, you know, that wasn't the truth. And so sometimes it becomes even difficult trying to control all that negativity that is going out there. Because mm-hmm. you have to control your brand, etc. We know about the tweets, people putting out information out there that is either not true or athletes that tweet things that they cannot take back.
Exactly. And what also strikes me is that when the athletes make it big, there are people who are digging up tweets from 5-6 years ago.
Yes.
You know, from when people are teenagers.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, if anybody has, one shouldn't be tweeting certain things because, you know, of a respect for human dignity and, humanity. But having said that, you know, if you have your mind on an athletic career, you know, even as a teenager, you start to have to kind of think long-term and manage that image.
But Chris, that is hard. Meaning that teenagers, especially on social media, think that is just an outlet to express mm-hmm. themselves. And it's funny you say that, because just a few days ago, I was talking to a very top track and field athlete, mm-hmm. Jamaican, who said that, you know, what they did was just to dig up some tweets that mm-hmm. she, since she, so you can figure out who it is, she, you know, mentioned years ago, you know, as mm-hmm. a youngster, she was just tweeting. Mm-hmm. Those have been left there. Once she became a star, people just went for those.
Yeah.
And they had hacked into her account, so mm-hmm. they just started to retweet it.
Right.
And retweet all of those, you know, mm-hmm. so people start to saying, Jesus, and, you know, them things that she talked about. So a lot of those, they have to be careful of. So, I mean, the moral of the story is that at least just have to be very, very careful.
Yeah, of course. And you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So on the one hand, it does seem, I think, to many of us, a bit extreme that people are being, you know, punished for tweets that they may have sent out into the universe a long time ago for, you know, sometimes, you know, just having a personal opinion. But as I say, you live by the sword. And in this case, living by the sword is that they're also paid millions of dollars for endorsing certain things and for having an opinion.
Right.
Right? So this is just, you know, the deal that they have made.
Talk about opinion. Mm-hmm. Usain Bolt has an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Usain think that you know, his coach is being attacked and uh-huh. he has an opinion. I'm going to save you from being banned in Jamaica uh-huh. for an opinion on this. But to ask you, do you think it is okay for athletes, whether retired or otherwise, especially just retired, to have a personal opinion on, you know, topical issues, etc.? And again, for our listeners, we're not even talking about Usain Bolt here.
Sure. I mean, I would like to say one thing in regards to that, which is I think we can all agree that regardless of which side of the divide you're on, if you wear size 10, you shouldn't be putting it into an 8.5 shoe. Having gotten that out of the way.
All right. You're just putting out that in the atmosphere.
Just saying that, you know, I think that, is, you know, in moments of divide, we have to see the things that we can all rally around and agree on.
Right, and that's one thing we can rally around.
But the question, you know, should athletes have opinions? Should athletes put them out there?
Voice those opinions, yeah.
I certainly think that they should. I think that whether they, you know, necessarily accept the role or not, that they are tremendously influential, and therefore if they have particular opinions and want to shape, you know, the way people think, then that is a very good thing for them to do, you know. However, I understand if athletes are reluctant to do it simply because, as we've seen, you know, sharing opinions comes with consequences. And there's a famous Michael Jordan quote that Republicans buy Nikes too, right? You know, to explain his, you know, just, you know, lack of political activities. But I think that it is a good thing for athletes to have opinions. I think it is a good thing to share them. I always think, of course, that it is important how things are said, right? And even, you know, not getting into the details of the particular issue that you raised, you know, I do think that a lot of the problem, a lot of the divisiveness, a lot of the anger has come from the way in which certain feelings and messages have been conveyed. And I do think that, you know, in particular, if we're talking about Jamaica, we have a societal problem when it comes to the way we express our differences, the way we express our disagreements, you know. Yeah. We're a violent set of people.
Yeah, at times. That's true. At times we are. You know, listen, my position on it is that athletes should be free to air their positions on any issue, knowing though that just like a normal person, whichever side you take, mm-hmm. it can come with its own consequences. So you have to know that. In relation to the Usain Bolt thing, I've said this over and over that I think Usain should be free to express his feeling about, mm-hmm. you know, what he said about his coach, how he says it. I guess that is his way, you know. I mean, that's one thing. But I agree with an article by Tanya Lee, which just says that family feud just don't help. You know, family feud, it really doesn't help. And sometimes you have to just figure these things out in-house. But the entire thing is just unfortunate.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, you say family feud, right? And, you know, part of the wider kind of like social problems that I alluded to a while ago is, I don't think as a country, even as a region, a Caribbean region, we have really come far enough in terms of how we manage human resources. Mm-hmm. And we see it everywhere. You know, again, if you go to cricket, you've seen this long-standing dispute between players and board. You've seen it many times with players and different national associations, right? You know, I think one of the things is that we have to recognize that this particular generation of athletes, of Jamaicans, of Caribbean people, are in search of a respect that maybe has not been accorded to our ancestors, and the wealth that they can earn from sport gives them a kind of independence that allows them to kind of demand a respect that maybe previous athletes have not. And I think that that has led to, you know, a lot of kind of clashes, because we have this authority system in the Caribbean, this typical kind of autocratic, you know, dictatorial way of administering, and that needs to change, right? So I think, you know, what we need is just a center. There is no reason, as you're suggesting, for some that particular, you know, dispute to have become public in the way that it has, right?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Julian. Listen, Thanks again, Julian, for joining us. Remember that this will be a new feature. I hope that all of our listeners learn something. Julian knows a lot. So Julian, thank you very much.
I'm very glad to be here. You know, anytime, I'm glad to share, glad to talk these things.
All right, great. On behalf of studio engineer Andre and producer Rashika Grant, thanks for listening to us on this week's episode of The Dry Phase. Remember, make sure you subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Remember, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, so go tell a friend about the show so they too can spread the word. Feel free to send feedback, comments, or questions to thedryphase@gmail.com or look us up on Twitter and Facebook at thedryphase. Use the hashtag TDP for all things The Dry Phase. Until next time, see you then.